to try and see what these levels are like. And while we're doing that, I should say that when I first heard that essay given, I was deep in my American life, and I found it enormously pleasurable, as I did this time. But I was thinking about at that time, I was deep in pie a la mode, crab cakes, and apple cider, all the apple cider of the fall that we used to have. So I found your essay at that point an enormous kind of a celebration of American food, which I really loved. But listening to it this time, and in this context, it just struck me how much, two things, just how much the practice of 20th century art has, as you say, been developed alongside the practices of food, from swallowing to dinner, from Peach Melba to Gordon Matter-Clark's restaurant, which is now White Walls Gallery in New York. The history of food and art are enormously intertwined, and it also feels like that this is another moment when coming to the table has become really important, and it might be an interesting place to start. For instance, the Tate is having a short conference in June, which is devoted to the idea of the short, where people have been asked to give 7-minute contributions, but it all takes place around a dinner table, so that you'll give short contributions, and then really the idea is to have dinner as an art event. And I wondered what you feel about that idea, because you've absolutely put your thumb or finger on it, that food and art are entirely intertwined.
It's funny you mentioned pie a la mode. I do have a piece in there about one of these well-known American novelists who recalls in a memoir, in the essay that I chose of his, his childhood, when his aunt and mother would drive all around the United States trying to find the best pie.
Yeah.
You know, like apple pie and fruit pies and everything are really, they're just a kind of American staple. But the whole question of food and art, it changes in different eras. I mentioned, like, you know, Judy Chicago and Jean Anthony, and some of the people in early feminist art used it in such a way to kind of make a critique about the kitchen and dieting and all of that. Now, I'm just trying to think of people who use food. One of the more compelling recent things I saw was a piece by Rodrigo Garcia, and this is very disturbing because it had deep implications within Latin American culture, and his work has been shown a lot in Avignon. There was one or two people in a space, and there was just like the slow burning of a lobster. Which then eventually died from the heat and then was eaten by would-be, say, interrogator or state, some kind of an official, seeming like an interrogator, relating to a kind of torture situation. And people were disturbed, but it was also disturbing because you don't know whether we would do anything to stop humans being tortured, but they were very disturbed at watching this lobster. So that's a clear case of something that's much more, much more political in terms of the use of food. What you mentioned about the Tate in terms of shorts, what exactly are the artists doing around the table?
Well, they're basically giving very short speeches on any subject that they like. And the idea is, instead of a room, that there's a table, which is something I think that's kind of really come back into fashion. In fact, a few weeks ago, I saw an article in The Observer which was talking about Jim Haynes, who founded the Traverse Theatre in Edinburgh, for instance, hosts a drop-in Sunday supper in Paris that's advertised on the internet where anybody can come. It kind of feels like it's developed once again into a new kind of art project that anybody can come to. And yes. Oh, true. It's the most amazing noise going on out there.
That was for weekend events on Saturday and Sunday.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not really certain whether people will return to eating dinner at home and not restaurants have become very, very expensive. And it also depends on different cities. Some people have more of a tradition of eating home and not eating out all the time. But certainly it seems like in terms of artworks and films and the rise of restaurant culture, that there is something about the intimacy of the dining table that is attracting people. And also, you know, the emphasis on design and restoring, you know, the architecture of your home, or just being happy with your home and going more toward, you know, issues of comfort and simple foods and conversation, and just the home has become a different kind of focal point. Mm. But that remains to be seen in terms of the economics of, you know, the next couple of years, whether there's going to be a real change. But I think that the rise of I linked in my piece the rise of storytelling and in different art forms with the rise of restaurant culture, too. They seem to be linked, and the interest in the personal, the autobiographical. Now, of course, we're seeing that in the extreme with reality shows and all of that. You know, so that's another issue.
Thank you.
Things that are sort of twisted, for example, like the emphasis that people place on redesigning their kitchen, you know, like the lavish sums of money that people have spent on that, and also the fact that a lot of people no longer, I don't know what the situation is here in England, but in the U.S., a lot of people simply, a lot of families simply don't eat together.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are many things that are, you know, maybe just a question of desire, but not reality. It's hard to say. It depends on the class, the country,
Kate.
Economics.
Say how much I enjoyed your talk.
Oh, thank you.
And I was put in mind of Bobby Baker, who made artworks out of food and turned the ICA into an art supermarket. But the idea being that women's work
briefly, you know, Linda Montano's Holy Anorexia. Linda was the one who did this in 1981 in High Performance, an American experimental or American kind of avant-garde arts journal that was, I think, founded or certainly edited by Linda Burnham. And Linda, it grew out of, obviously, Linda's own anorexia. She still has problems with food. She's a good friend of mine. She's a former nun also. So there are a lot of things going on in that, but she's the one who first edited that issue in 1981. That's a long time ago. And many, many male and female artists dealt with issues. I also mentioned people who did pieces on dieting and fasting. So from the start, it was always a kind of critique of the politics. politics of women's bodies, of the kitchen, the semiotics of the kitchen, of Martha Rosler. These are some major feminist figures also in creating feminist art. Judy Chicago's piece. Many of these people were also from the West Coast who started their own galleries and women's space, a whole art building. So it was very deeply connected with issues of feminism. While many of the male artists were making kitchens, like Tom Wesselman, pop art, Oldenburg, they made kitchens, but it didn't really embody a critique of, say, women's place in the kitchen. Mm. It was more about new consumer items and new materials and things like that. So it's definitely carried on almost half a century. But then we go back to, as I mentioned, Dadaism and Futurism. Obviously, food, the whole consciousness of food in Italy was very much a part of the early avant-garde of Futurism. Mm. And Futurists had a lot of different restaurants in Milan and Torino and Rome. So the whole thinking about the avant-garde, it was so comprehensive in the Futurists that they thought about cities and toys, but also food and pasta. Many of you may have seen the Futurist cookbook, which was published in English many, many years or decades after all the material was actually available. And the food manifestos were really not part of our early understanding of Futurism in terms of the first kinds of manifestos that were published. Mm. And there's Alice B. Toklas's book, was also published, I think, in the 60s.
Yeah, absolutely.
And John Cage, many of John Cage's essays have been available for decades.
Yeah. Birgitta.
You sort of briefly talked about slow food movement and GM crops, and I wonder what you thought of some contemporary artists who are using genetic modification of plants as artworks. For example, Heath Bunting, who made a genetically modified superweed that can't be killed with pesticides as an art project and distributed it over the internet. And there was also some people at the Royal College about a couple of years ago who injected their own DNA into trees.
I don't know about those particular things. There have been certain kind of scientific experiments in the U.S. that I know vaguely about. And there also I've seen various installations here and abroad that had to do with, plants and seeds and all of that. Sometimes they're just sort of a reflection rather than, imaginative projects. It depends on, one by one, judging something in an individual way. But these particular ones you mentioned, I'm not aware of them.
But I wonder if we could sort of turn it slightly around, because the other thing, just to pick up on something Kate said, that really I wanted to pick up on you in your essay, is that the essay itself is really about pleasure. And one of the things that you really do in it is to have you use a lot of words like luscious and delicious, and you have a luscious pleasure in the words that you use. And of course that returns us in a way to some of the pleasures of art writing, if you like, as well. And I think that's something we might sort of talk about a little, because I think one of the sly things you do is to talk about the enormous pleasures of food, and you're also talking about the pleasures of art in a very sensuous way that in fact we've kind of got away from, perhaps, as well. And it's what started to go through my mind was how much I've appreciated your style over the years. And then a number of other stylists of art writing start to come through my mind as well. And I wonder if that resonates with other people, because it is something that's very important to me about writing. Caroline, what were you going
to
say?
Yeah, just in relation, I've mentioned this idea of ingestion and excretion as part of the traffic of food through the body, and also the traffic of culture, and therefore also of language through the body and out again. And I think perhaps there's something there also, not just the bulimic aspect, but also the whole idea of how one uses language and how to ingest and excrete language, like Arthur, some of his metaphors. Pasolini, has things also to do with that. Buñuel, very much a sense that you can ingest it and it's beautiful, but then you also have to, Cindy Sherman has this wonderful, these shit photos or whatever they are, there's a whole series about that. And I thought that's interesting too about the grotesque, the deformed in culture.
Ron Booth.
Since you mentioned those things, I mean, you probably saw a little, like, I mean, I would lean more toward Bachelard and Roland Barthes, you know. I don't consider myself a political writer, you know. I mean, I'm the piece in my book is, you know, Roland Barthes on chopsticks, or Umberto Eco and eating on planes, you know, or as I mentioned, the Susan Sontag piece, which is the conceit of it is that each section is named after utensils, and it's about a dinner that she had with John Cage and Jasper Johns and Merce Cunningham. So while I, you know, touch things on politics, I don't really consider myself like a political writer. I don't look for things. I mean, I try to be like a thinking person in the world. And obviously, I write about things that interest me or other kind of hobbies and things that I don't think this is on.
It is.
Okay.
It's a playback.
Like, or other, you know, hobbies and these literary anthologies that I do in, like, my... with other interests, but I put as much time and attention into them as I would in my theater writing. But I lean toward a more belles lettres and not an expert point of view, but the way that we people used to be able to write without feeling compelled.